From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. NBC is citing two unnamed senior intelligence officials who say Russian President Vladimir Putin was directly involved with the hacking of Democratic National Committee emails. NBC also says the hacking campaign started as a vendetta against Hillary Clinton, but evolved into a broader effort to undermine U.S. credibility around the world and expose corruption in the U.S. election process. Now, there's no confirmation of the NBC reporting from any government agency, but we had planned a look at Putin today, so let's do that now with Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist. And Ed, others have presumed Putin, the former KGB agent, was involved, but you say you're not surprised. Why?
Because the Kremlin has been doing this in other countries in Europe for years, and they get better and better at it every time. They did it in Georgia and swung the result of an election there. They've done it in Poland. They've also, I would say, been intervening in both the Scottish independence referendum in Britain and in the Brexit referendum. And they've now refined these hacking and leaking tactics to a real fine art. And you in the United States have been the recipients of this. And it's a very major development, I think, in our political history, that you can now affect another country's elections by stealing emails and recording private conversations and then releasing them with a media who unquestioningly accept this as evidence of scandal, and then go off and publish stories which can have an effect on the election result.
Well, this is what the New York Times addressed, the notion that, of course, the U.S. has interfered in other countries' elections in the past as well. But what is different now, particularly with, you know, Donald Trump's seeming support of Vladimir Putin? He's gone against his own party in his praise of Putin. We remember during the convention, his campaign fought to gut the party platform, to take out language about arming Ukraine or calling for reducing sanctions. His first top aide, Paul Manafort, was an advisor to the Putin-backed president of Ukraine. Trump's nominee for Secretary of State has done business with Putin. This, of course, the CEO of ExxonMobil. There are knockoffs of Trump's apprentice show in Russia and Chechnya. What do you make of that, those ties?
There are certainly some very questionable ties on the Trump side with the Kremlin. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Trump is the Manchurian candidate. I think the big question is, what will Mr. Trump's president, when he is president, Trump's policy towards Russia be? And there I see two dangers. One is that he just mishandles a crisis. The other danger is that he tries to do a grand bargain with Mr. Putin. And I think that's what people are mainly worried about over here.
Well, let's just back up a second. We're in the 25th anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. President Mikhail Gorbachev resigning on Christmas Day in 1991. Boris Yeltsin takes over. Vladimir Putin, a Yeltsin protege, he rises to power from the KGB, which is where he spent his time. Just who is Vladimir Putin for those just kind of, tuning into this?
He's not a communist. He doesn't really believe in the one-party state. He's got a very different idea, which is that Russia has a geopolitical destiny, which allows it to determine the fortunes of neighboring countries. And also, he believes that Russia is a great power, must be treated as a great power. So I think it's really Putin, the imperialist or the neo-imperialist, which is the most important thing here, with his very strong one could almost say addiction, or certainly penchant, to the methods of the old KGB, doing things in the shadows, behind the scenes, with a mixture of money, blackmail, dirty tricks, propaganda, and all the other things that there were such important measures in the KGB armory, and are even more effective now.
Well, in fact, doesn't the Kremlin feel that they are as under attack from the West as, you know, the West might feel right now, that they're under attack by the Kremlin? We're reading in Newsweek, for instance, the Kremlin's new army of spooks is motivated by a single ideology: to fight back against a supposed Western campaign to undermine Russian power, to foment unrest in places like Georgia and Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan.
I can understand why the Kremlin hates it that countries that used to be in their pocket are wriggling out of their pocket and heading towards us. But I don't think that that is a view we accommodate. I think we have to say to the Russians, we'd be delighted if you would also have an open political system and would be friends with us and help make constructive contributions to all the problems the world faces. So long as you don't want to, unfortunately, there's not much business we can do. But we are definitely going to stick up for these countries of these people who believe the same things that we do.
So Edward Lucas, where do you think this is heading? You have a Putin, a Russia emboldened in Syria, you know, started up airstrikes again there, helping to completely shut down Aleppo for Assad. emboldened, according to reports, meddling in the U.S. election. Where does this go?
We have to accept that Russia is winning. So I think we're going to see the same thing now in Germany and in France, particularly directed at Angela Merkel, the German leader, who is now, in effect, the leader of the free world. She's almost the last man standing, or in her case, last woman standing. And we have to get our act together, because we're losing this because we're weak-willed and badly organised. And until we get our act together, I'm afraid that we're going to continue to allow Russia to make hay, and with potentially terrifying consequences.
That's Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist. His book again, Cyberphobia, Identity, Trust, Security, and the Internet. Ed, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, in Oregon, a judge is considering whether to grant a new trial to a man who was convicted by a non-unanimous jury. In all but two states, jury verdicts must be unanimous for felony convictions that don't involve murder. But that's not what happens in Oregon, where prosecutors need just 10 out of 12 jurors to win their case. Conrad Wilson from Here and Now contributor Oregon Public Broadcasting reports, and a note, his story begins with some graphic content.
This summer, after days of testimony and a few hours of deliberating, a jury found Olan Williams guilty of first-degree sodomy. He was convicted of performing oral sex on a man who was passed out drunk in his apartment. Two jurors disagreed with that verdict. In 48 other states, that would be enough for a hung jury. But Williams was sentenced to more than 8 years in prison.
In Oregon, you can be convicted of any felony other than murder on a 10-2 verdict. In every other state except Louisiana, it needs to be a unanimous verdict.
That's Ryan Scott, the lawyer who took over Williams' case after his conviction. He's seeking a new trial and says Oregon's law, the one that allows non-unanimous jury verdicts, violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Williams is black, and so is one of the jurors who voted not to convict. Aliza Kaplan directs the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland.
The original purpose of Oregon's non-unanimous rule really has behind it discrimination.
Kaplan says Oregon's unique law was passed by voters in a 1934 ballot measure, which made it part of the state constitution. She says it was originally meant to prevent European immigrants from having a say on juries.
Everyone really must understand the times. This is the early 30s, Depression. We had just sort of come out of a 10-year period where the Ku Klux Klan was very popular around the state with a lot of power, a lot of political power.
In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Oregon and Louisiana's non-unanimous jury laws. But today, critics say Oregon's law discriminates against people of color. Cash Singleton is African-American. She was one of the dissenting jurors in Olan Williams' case.
This case actually showed exactly what's wrong with it.
Singleton did not vote to convict Williams because she didn't believe he committed a crime. But because of Oregon's jury law, her vote, in essence, didn't matter.
A lot of people of color have a overall distrust of the criminal justice system. They feel like serving on juries, it doesn't do any good because it's really white people running everything. So what good does it do for us to even bother?
Research shows jurors are more likely to convict people of a different race than themselves.
So if you are a white juror and you're looking at a black defendant, you are more likely to convict somebody who is black.
Matt Dos Santos is the legal director for the ACLU of Oregon, which has filed a brief in support of a new trial for Williams. Dos Santos says his concerns about non-unanimous criminal convictions go beyond race.
Stop and think about it. If there are two people in that room saying, I don't believe it, I think there's a reasonable doubt. And so not getting to a unanimous jury, I think, undercuts some of the foundations of our, you know, what we truly believe is important in criminal justice.
Despite its history, the non-unanimous jury amendment has its supporters. Josh Marquis is a district attorney in Oregon and says the state system works.
It does not raise the number of convictions. What it does is it reduces the number of mistrials for hung juries.
Marquis says the law also works both ways. It's just as easy to acquit someone in Oregon as it is to convict them. But not all prosecutors agree with Marquis. John Hummel is a district attorney based in Central Oregon. He says a 10-2 verdict means 17% of the jury disagrees with the decision.
17% of unbiased people who discuss something disagreed with the ultimate decision. Well, that's not the confidence level that I think our justice system should deliver.
Hummel says it's critical for jurors to consider and wrestle with opinions they don't agree with and not be able to dismiss them so quickly.
We have a more efficient system of justice, but the flip side is you have a more efficient system of justice that might be delivering more verdicts that are unjust. And so the question is your goal justice or efficiency?
If a judge grants Williams a new trial, the ruling won't have any bearing on Oregon's constitutional amendment that allows for non-unanimous verdicts. But critics of non-unanimous juries think Williams' case could find a path to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the justices could revisit the issue. For Here and Now, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland, Oregon.
Donald Trump's nomination of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State comes as Exxon is in a battle with environmental groups, the Rockefeller Family Charities, and more than a dozen state attorneys general who are exploring charging Exxon with consumer fraud for an alleged campaign of climate change denial. Let's back up. In 2015, two major journalism projects, one from the Columbia Grad School of Journalism, published in the Los Angeles Times, one from Inside Climate News, came to the separate conclusions that while Exxon scientists were once leaders in global warming research, that changed publicly in 1988. Exxon says that's not true, that the company does recognize the effects of climate change, and the studies cherry-picked information as part of a conspiracy because both groups were funded by the Rockefeller Family Fund. David Kaiser is a trustee of the Rockefeller Family Fund. He's also the great-great-grandson of John D. Rockefeller, the founder of Standard Oil, which begat Exxon, which is why it was startling to many this year when he and the Family Fund announced they would divest holdings in fossil fuel companies. In a recent article, he laid out the reasons why. He joins us now. And David, it was because of what those journalists found last year. So give us the overarching view.
What they found was that starting in the late 1970s, Exxon, with its vast scientific resources, understood and internally accepted the reality of climate change. Different teams of journalists found a huge trove of documents, many of them from Exxon's own archives. They understood the huge threat that it posed to their business, right? Because it's not just that the climate is changing, it's that the combustion of fossil fuel, which is their product, is causing the change and that it's going to lead to catastrophe.
You write about a memo from 1977, an Exxon scientist named James Black, who gave a presentation to the company's management committee and explained what the greenhouse effect was and how it was steadily increasing. Here's a quote, "Present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical."
There were many examples of this. That's part of the point here, and it really goes to Exxon's cherry-picking accusation. If these journalists have been cherry-picking documents, they found an extraordinarily bountiful harvest of cherries, because we have memos from many Exxon scientists and senior executives, and they're all saying the same thing, that the science is becoming clear. We understand that burning fossil fuels is going to dramatically change the climate and that that is going to have catastrophic consequences for much of humanity, likely by the middle of the 21st century.
Well, here's another one from Roger Cohen, director of Exxon's Theoretical and Mathematical Sciences Laboratory in 1982. He wrote, "There is unanimous agreement in the scientific community that a temperature increase of this magnitude, the one that he had described, would bring about significant changes in the Earth's climate, including rainfall distribution and alterations in the biosphere." I mean, the examples go on. So what happened in 1988?
Well, 1988, there was the costliest drought in American history. There was a heat wave that claimed more than 5,000 lives, and the NASA scientist James Hansen testified to Congress that climate change is real, it is coming soon, and it will affect all peoples. And all of a sudden, this issue, which really hadn't penetrated the public consciousness, was everywhere. Time magazine, instead of naming a person of the year that year, named Endangered Earth its planet of the year. And Exxon got scared because they realized that if humanity started to take climate change seriously, that would mean making changes in the nature of our energy economy, which could be really injurious to its business. So Exxon decided on a campaign to deceive the public about the validity of climate science.
Well, and here is seems like a pretty damning memo In August 1988, an Exxon public affairs manager drafted the memo, The Greenhouse Effect, and saying that the principal greenhouse gases are byproducts of fossil fuel combustion. But then he went on to write, the Exxon position would now be to emphasize the uncertainty in scientific conclusions regarding the potential enhanced greenhouse effect.
It is laid out there. But something that's not quite as apparent is that in deciding on this campaign to deceive the public about the validity of climate science, it seems quite clear that Exxon consciously modeled what it was doing after the long campaign that the tobacco industry engaged in to deceive the public about the danger of smoking. They found unscrupulous scientists who would misrepresent the scientific consensus, and then they also found and funded right-wing think tanks that would serve as echo chambers for the claims of these scientists. But in addition to that, they actually used many of the very same scientists and think tanks that the tobacco industry had used in its denial campaign.
Well, you say also that Exxon didn't just rely on those scientists, but also published what you call advertorials on the editorial page of the New York Times questioning the reality of climate change and its human cause. Look, you know that Exxon says that you pretty much do the same thing, that you fund nonprofits that then come to the conclusions that you espouse.
The journalists who we gave a grant to are independent journalists with a real creed of ethics of their own. And when we were first in discussions with them about this, we didn't single out Exxon, by the way. We said it would be interesting to know what the fossil fuel industry generally knew about climate change and when. And the reason Exxon became such a point of emphasis is that they found so much damning information about Exxon. That's not to say that there isn't damning information about the other companies, because I believe that there is. But they found much more about Exxon in terms of what it had known about climate change, and people had already known much more about what Exxon had done to deceive the public.
You and others take it further. You say that ExxonMobil even called the George W. Bush White House and asked that scientists who embraced climate change be fired, and you say they were.
They were, and in many cases, Exxon named its preferred replacement.
Well, look, after publication of these articles, the Rockefeller Fund was subpoenaed for documents related to activism by Representative Lamar Smith, a Texas Republican, a friend of Exxon. He's accusing your foundations and the attorneys general, who are also trying to get these documents they say reveal that Exxon knew about climate change and its effects, even as it publicly questioned the science. Smith says you are taking part in a coordinated effort to deprive companies, nonprofit organizations, and scientists of their First Amendment rights and ability to fund and conduct scientific research free from intimidation and threats of prosecution. That's the case that Exxon is making, that this was their free speech to say whatever they wanted about climate change.
Well, big corporations aren't the only ones that have free speech, right? And one of the things that we're all free to say is when somebody else is making inaccurate claims or dishonest claims.
Well, the judge has allowed that claim that they are arguing on the basis of freedom of speech. And so we'll watch as that goes forward. But meantime, we have Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO, tapped to be President-elect Donald Trump's Secretary of State. In your opinion, did Rex Tillerson knowingly deny climate change when he and the scientists in his company knew the dangers of it? And do you think he should be Secretary of State?
I do not think that Tillerson should be Secretary of State. It's a little bit complicated here, and the reason is that there's a huge gulf between what Exxon said about climate under Tillerson and what it actually did. So was Tillerson really a climate denier? I'm not sure that I would go quite that far. Because when he became CEO, what ExxonMobil said about climate change did shift, okay? The company admitted for the first time that climate change is real after he became CEO. A couple of years after that, it declared that the danger of climate change is serious enough that it supported a carbon tax in this country. It claims it no longer supports climate denial organizations.
So if there was a shift, a public shift under Tillerson, isn't that to his credit?
No, because they shifted in what they said, but not in what they did, okay? And a lot of the press has missed this so far. The New York Times, for example, on Tuesday ran an editorial that was otherwise very critical of the Tillerson pick, but it actually praised his record on climate change. And honestly, I think that's a really embarrassing failure of journalism because ExxonMobil says it supports a carbon tax, but it continues to give much more money in campaign contributions to members of Congress who deny the reality of climate change and oppose any such tax than to those who would support one. And the company has put absolutely no muscle behind any effort to pass such a tax. So if Tillerson wants us to believe that he supports a carbon tax, I want to see some actual evidence of that. Similarly, the company claims that it has stopped funding climate denial organizations, but that is demonstrably false. It still does give significant support to many important climate denial organizations. For example, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a creation of the Koch brothers. ExxonMobil has given ALEC major funding and even has a seat on its board of directors. Many other companies like BP, Walmart, Shell, and Google have stopped funding ALEC because of its climate denial lies, but Exxon has not.
David Kaiser, just a couple minutes here. Is there some guilt on the part of the Rockefellers that's motivating you? Again, your great-great-grandfather founded Standard Oil.
Honestly, it is not a question of guilt. I don't think that I'm responsible for what my great-great-grandfather did, and I certainly don't think I'm responsible for what the company he founded became generations later. We wouldn't be bad-mouthing ExxonMobil if there weren't excellent reason to do so, because it is not in our financial interest to do this. You know, the family still owns quite a lot of ExxonMobil stock in trust, meaning that we're not able to sell it even if we wanted to. And if what we say hurts the company, as they seem to think it will, we will actually suffer financially.
David Kaiser, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Kaiser of the Rockefeller Family Fund. We've asked Exxon for the response. Meanwhile, they post many responses at their website. They write in part, ExxonMobil completely rejects the allegations made in the journalist's studies. They also list the actions ExxonMobil is doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We'll link you. You can read more at hereandnow.org.
That is the new sound of Super Mario. It's coming to iPhones and iPads today. The new Nintendo game Super Mario Run, available now. It is the first game that Nintendo has developed specifically for mobile devices. More than a half a billion copies of the non-mobile Mario games have been sold since the 1980s. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Nintendo has long resisted creating a game specifically for mobile devices. So why the change now?
Yeah, that's what a lot of people are saying. Why so late, right? There have been so many games out. You remember Angry Birds years ago, taking advantage of basically a game console in people's pockets. Nintendo says that it had to wait until the iPhone sort of infrastructure got good enough to be able to handle a complex game. And we'll see. We'll see if they have come into the game too late.
Well, one of the things about this game is that you have to be connected to the internet in order to play it. Why is that?
Yeah, Nintendo says they're doing that to cut down on any pirating of the game, to make sure that you can't make copies outside. So it's one of these little quirks that Nintendo is doing a little bit differently than most other game makers.
And it's also going to cost people just about $10 to buy it. You can play the lowest levels for free, it sounds like, but after that you have to actually pay $10. Is that going to be a competitive problem for Nintendo? Because a lot of other games you don't have to pay for.
Yeah, so this is raising a lot of eyebrows with analysts too, because most games are free or very cheap, and then you often have sort of in-game purchases where the real money comes along. Nintendo says it doesn't want people to have to stop playing, pay something, and keep playing again. So they're doing something differently. Now, some analysts say that this could cost Nintendo a lot of money because they don't have this sort of long ramp of revenue down the road. They're getting it all up front. But I also think it's often a good sign when a company tries to find something that just works for them and doesn't copy what everybody else is doing.
How does this fit into the larger picture of what Nintendo is doing? And are they going to turn their focus now, after all these years, really to mobile?
Not yet. I mean, the company still has a mobile console coming out next year. The company has dealt with this problem before, right? There have always been computers that play computer games, but Nintendo has made so much money on selling the Wii game station, selling consoles themselves along with the games. So it's always been trying to figure out how to sort of manage selling hardware and games and also, you know, sell games directly. So I think they're going to try to straddle the fence here for a while. It may be that someday they don't have that console business, but right now they're trying to do both.
Kurt, just one quick thing before we let you go. Another big story going on in the world of tech, which is that Yahoo says it's been hacked again. More than a billion users' data stolen. How did this happen again with Yahoo?
Yeah, so this hack apparently was in 2013. This eclipses in size what was the largest one of 500 million from 2014. Yahoo said that that one was a state actor. It's not clear who did this one, although a lot of security experts think it might be a state actor too, because a lot of this hasn't been done. A lot of the data hasn't been sold online.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. And I guess we're back to Nintendo. This is Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump's senior aide, Kellyanne Conway, said this week that it's a very big priority to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something Donald Trump has talked about, but would be a significant reversal of longstanding policy. Joining us now is Aaron David Miller, who's a vice president at the Wilson Center and a former advisor to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state on Mideast issues. Aaron David Miller, welcome back.
Jeremy, it's a pleasure to be here.
And first, just give us some background on this. Why are the U.S. Embassy and other embassies in Tel Aviv rather than Jerusalem?
In large part, it has to do, and the situation has evolved over the years. In 1948, the U.N. recognized Jerusalem as a corpus separatum, and it was intended to be an international city. I don't think anyone ascribes to that position today, but given the sensitivities of Jerusalem as the years went on, the U.S. that recognized Israel in 1948 opened a consular section initially in Tel Aviv, which was then the seat of the Israeli government. When the Israeli government moved its capital in 1950 to Jerusalem, the U.S. joined a number of other countries in protesting and refusing to do so based on the earlier U.N. pronouncements. And once negotiations began, in roughly in the 1990s, serious negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, Jerusalem's status as a final status issue and its the sensitivities around it basically mandated the fact that, at least for the U.S., that we would continue to dance around the issue. We maintain a consulate in West Jerusalem, but have taken the position that until the final status of Jerusalem is resolved in negotiations, in mutual agreement, presumably, between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the United States government was not going to change its position on Jerusalem. And technically, the U.S. does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over any part of the city, West or East, nor does it recognize that Jerusalem is Israel's eternal capital as mandated by an Israeli basic law in 1980. And it has continued to maintain that position, which among many constituencies. I'm pretty sure that the issue of Jerusalem remains the only example of a situation in which the host country would like its embassy to be located in a particular city, but the U.S. has basically declared that such a move, in this case, was detrimental to its national security.
So, but Congress did pass legislation in 1995 that required the embassy to move to Jerusalem. How come they haven't followed through on that? They've been passing these waivers every now and again.
Right. In October of 1995, the Senate approved what was then called, still is, the Jerusalem Embassy Act, and the House passed it as well. It came with a national security waiver, and subsequent presidents, President Clinton, President Bush, 43, and President Obama, continue to exercise that waiver. That waiver comes up, I believe, in June of 2017, and it will be intriguing, fascinating, and interesting to see exactly how the incoming administration after January 20th, President Trump deals with the Jerusalem issue.
Well, Bob Corker, who is a Republican senator from Tennessee and chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was on Hardball with Chris Matthews last night. And here's what he said about Trump's proposal to move the embassy to Jerusalem.
Candidly, I've talked to the Israelis about it. And I think that there's a way to communicate the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem. I think you know what we have there is a consulate now that really works only on the Palestinian side. But I think there's a way of doing it if you communicate that you're still hoping and working towards a two-state solution. So I know he campaigned on it. I actually think it would be something at this point that would not be negative and could be very positive in moving things along.
Do you agree with that, that this moving the embassy to Jerusalem could actually be a part of bringing the peace process back up?
You know, I respect Bob Corker. He's a really smart guy. He knows the Middle Eastern issues well, and he knows the sensitivity on the Jerusalem issue as well. I don't, frankly. I think that moving the embassy to Jerusalem, certainly early in the Trump administration, with very little context, no negotiation underway, and no prospect of negotiations, I think would be harmful. And my point of departure, and it should resonate particularly well for a President Trump, who is clearly has made clear he wants to be a transactor in chief, that if the United States takes a position on an issue, it ought to be one that benefits and advances American interests. I understand that certain constituencies, certainly the government of Israel, many American Jews, many evangelical Christians, and many Israelis would welcome the move. I mean, I get that. But I do not understand, as an American and as someone who has labored mightily, unsuccessfully, in the wonderful world of Arab-Israeli and Israeli-Palestinian negotiation, why this should be done and how it really advances our interests. I don't think it advances our interests in three respects. Number one, sure, the peace process is comatose. There's no question. But an Israeli I know well who, with experience in negotiations, said that something could be dead or dead and buried. The peace process is dead. It may not be dead and buried. And if, in fact, an effort is made to prejudge or predetermine the outcome of these negotiations on such an incredibly combustible, explosive issue like Jerusalem, I think it's going to make even more difficult and rule out some of the possibilities that could actually exist in a Trump administration for moving this process forward. Second, I think at a time when the Middle East is literally melting down, transnational jihadi groups are ideologically using religion to foment all kinds of violence and terror, that putting Jerusalem into the mix is going to be viewed as a huge propaganda advantage, primarily to Sunni jihadis. And finally, I think you really are, in some respects, playing with fire. You have a city that has been, in some respects, even though it's witnessed its fair share of violence and confrontation, it has largely functioned, given the sensitivities on both sides and the potential for a major explosion, particularly around the overlapping sacred space known as the Haram al-Sharif, Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, and right, the noble enclosure, that if you inject this issue now into this kind of environment, I think the potential for a lot of violence and confrontation is great. And even if I'm wrong that, and you discount 50 or 60% of my analysis, why would you want to?
Well, and just to give people a sense of this, what you're talking about right there, I was just there just as a tourist and visited the Dome of the Rock, which is one of the holiest sites in Islam. And as a non-Muslim, you can't go into the mosque. You can get to the site, but only during a small period of the day. And there was a group of Orthodox Jews visiting, and they were surrounded by almost as many armed guards to make sure that they don't pray. These are very sensitive places, and there will be probably a lot of anger if the U.S. were to move its embassy to Jerusalem.
I mean, there'll be a clear decision to, quote-unquote, defend Jerusalem if, in fact, the United States takes this move. And I think, frankly, again, I come back to the initial and I would argue only point of departure, that in essence, when a president acts, the consequences of those actions need to be thought through carefully, and a balance sheet needs to be done. Not every action is cost-free. If this current administration decided that they wanted to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and as a part of that process, they made a policy pronouncement that in the context of a negotiated solution between Israelis and Palestinians, they would in fact support the idea that Palestinians, part of that city, even though it will and should never be divided, would serve as a functioning political capital in East Jerusalem. It's a very risky and difficult enterprise. But it would at least provide some sort of context. But I think we are playing with fire at a time when so much of the Middle East is already aflame. Let me put it this way. The U.S. has danced around this issue for half a century. In my judgment, and I'm not in government, I'm not running for anything, I work for Republicans and Democrats and voted for them too, we ought to keep dancing around this issue.
That's Aaron David Miller, who is a vice president at the Wilson Center and, as you just said there, former advisor to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state on Middle East issues. Aaron David Miller, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you.
Two brothers-in-law in central Pennsylvania will appear in court next week, in fact, just a couple days before Christmas, charged with defiant trespassing and prowling at night for the dumpster diving they've been doing, mostly for charity. Now, dumpster diving is not illegal in Pennsylvania, but they could be fined or jailed if they're convicted of the other charges. Tony Moyer and Sam Troyer join us by Skype from Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Tony, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi. And Sam, are you there too?
Yep, right here.
Okay, so Tony, you start. We understand you saw this surfing the net?
Yeah, I actually was on YouTube and came across some videos of people dumpster diving and was really intrigued by that. I decided to go out by myself and see what I could find. Then I asked Sam to join me.
So what were some of the things you were finding?
Like, I'd say like some electronics, clothing or stuff like that, and then just happened to check some other dumpsters, like a CVS, and saw they were throwing away some food.
Well, and we understand you started piling stuff on tables. I mean, you were finding so much stuff. What were you finding?
We would find a lot of, like, seasonal candy, stuff from, say, it was Halloween is over now, and now it's Christmas, so they can't really sell that.
Right.
A lot of, like, cookies, Oreos, and Chips Ahoy, and stuff like that.
We should say, because there's a huge ew factor, as you know, just developing among our listenership. This is unopened stuff, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Everything that we found was pre-packaged, was usually in bags from the store, like garbage bags, no trash in them, usually double bagged. So it wasn't really, as disgusting as some people may think. And we couldn't take it all. We couldn't possibly use it all. Our family was taking stuff and they couldn't possibly use it all. So we just started donating to a local food bank in our area.
Do I understand, too, you were donating to a school?
Yeah, I'd say 300-plus items. It was brand-new pens and pencils and paper binders.
Why would they throw that out? Look, we have spoken before with freegans. These are the anti-consumer people. They do this out of anger at waste or because they want to reduce their own impact on the world. They're angry about the cost of food. We know that, of course, homeless people dumpster dive out of necessity. And health officials say it can be dangerous. You can be hurt by the stuff that's in the dumpster. There might be hypodermic needles in there. And also, when food is thrown out, even if it's packaged, it's going to rot. And sometimes it gets sprayed by insecticide. And Sam, you can jump in. You were all concerned about the health risks here.
Yeah. Whenever we'd go into one of the dumpsters, we'd find that some items, like maybe were soiled by water, detergent, what have you, but we wouldn't take that. We would leave that behind.
Well, and what about the ethics of this? Now, the dumpster wasn't locked. There were no warning signs. We understand on most of them. The drugstore chain CVS, you were diving there. They don't want to press charges. But aren't you taking something that's not yours?
Well, it's actually not illegal to dumpster dive in Pennsylvania. So we figure, it's going to go to the landfill. This stuff is perfectly good. Most stuff is within date. Why can't we just give that to people that can use it?
Yeah. It does occur that, except for the fact that you're going inside these bins where there could be rats and things, there could be a health issue. It is sort of like going down the street and somebody's put out a chair they don't want. And so you just stop and take it. Not that I haven't done that a million times. Why not do it in a more organized way? There are tons of organizations. There's a group called Free for Food in our area that has arrangements with stores and restaurants. And they go and pick up everything that's unused. Why not make friends with your local CVS and say, look, before you throw out all that Valentine's Day candy, we'll come pick it up.
We actually did approach CVS. They basically said that they can't do that. They're not allowed to give it to us. I don't know if it was just because it was two guys.
Some food banks, the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, for one, says they won't accept dumpster food. Did you alert the food banks or the people you gave the food to that it came from a dumpster?
They never, you know, asked where it came from. And since, you know, Sam and I ate it and our family has been eating it, there was never a moral issue with that.
Yeah, for you.
So, yeah.
Well, so now, Tony and Sam, you've sort of found yourself in the middle of a whole movement of dumpster activists. There's a GoFundMe page for your defense. What do you hope to achieve now?
What we would like to do is get some food rescue programs up and running, you know, after the whole court thing is done, you know, local food banks, and see if they'll back us up. And then we'll go to some CVSs and talk to them and say, hey, you know, representing, you know, this food bank, can we have that instead of it, you know, going into the trash?
All right. Well, that's Tony Moyer. He and brother-in-law Sam Troyer speaking to us from Lebanon, Pennsylvania. There are criminal charges lodged against them for the trespassing and the prowling that they do when they dumpster dive. Tony, Sam, we'll stay in touch. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Jeremy, we'd love to hear from our listeners. I mean, this is a very controversial topic. Should dumpster diving be allowed? Should all those things, they were talking about electronics that they're pulling out of dumpsters, should they just be thrown out? But they are charged with defiant trespassing.
And I also love that today on the program, we can hear from both Lebanon and Lebanon.
That is true. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.